The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour,
we will be reading to you from
Daily Sci-Fi.
This is Dan Oliver reading A Voice the Color of Blood by Caroline M. Yokin. My senses are overwhelmed by the navy blue rumble of a distant explosion. A hush falls over the barracks as we listen for alien missiles outside. I close my eyes and wait in colorless silence. A coyote howls, a sunny yellow sound, and it breaks the tension in the room. My fellow soldiers return to the vibrant orange of their raucous conversations. I focus on Lorelei's voice, a deep crimson against the orange cacophony. Her words pour into my mind in the color of blood. Lorelei asked me one time what her voice looks like, and I described it as pomegranate red. Despite the rough conditions out here, she's never liked the sight of blood, and saying her voice sounds like pomegranates seemed more romantic. It's a new experience for me. Not the synesthesia. I've always had that. But hearing a specific person's voice for one of my colors. Lorelei's red used to sound like violins. Autumn from Vivaldi's Four Seasons. I can't remember when or how the shift happened. Was there a moment of transition when her voice was accompanied by the music? I guess it's like falling in love. I can't tell you exactly when it happened, but afterwards we knew. Lorelei tells me in gorgeous crimson words that she wants to have our wedding as soon as we get home from our tour of duty in the outer colonies. We've decided that both of us will wear our dress uniforms in the traditional white. She wants lilies for the bouquets and navy dresses for the bridesmaids. Will that sound okay? I consider the combination. White is a windy color, subtle and quiet, which will blend nicely with the low rumble of navy. The red of her voice will stand out nicely against those colors. It will be beautiful. But are you sure you don't want roses? We can find some that match your voice. I want my voice to be the only red you see that day, she says. I don't tell her that I hear her voice in bits and pieces everywhere, speaking words that sometimes make no sense. Even in the middle of a war zone, there's crimson on cigarette boxes and the glowing eyes of our alien attackers, and any time someone bleeds. Back home, the color will be everywhere. Even if we warn people in advance, some wedding guest will inadvertently wear lipstick in that shade or carry a purse that color. I enjoy having reminders of her everywhere I go, but if it makes her happy to think of the color as hers, who am I to argue? Anytime you speak, my entire world is red. Another explosion rattles the barracks. This one is closer and so loud that the navy blue is tinged with purple. The crisp, lemon-yellow bugle notes of the call to arms appear even before the colors of the explosion have faded. We suit up and file out of the barracks into the darkness of night. Piano notes in B minor, punctuated with faint whispers of two windy white moons. The spotlights on a makeshift tower behind us shine out past the perimeter so we can see anything that's coming our way. Hundreds of aliens rush across the band of light, and I'm overwhelmed by the clicking of their mint-green carapaces. My world is a muddle of color and sound. There are neon yellow flashes of gunfire from all directions and screams in shades that range from hot pink to lime green. Lorelei falls to the ground. Everything stops, and the chaos of color fades to the B-flat piano blackness of night. The battle is over. We've won. Lorelei does not move. She does not speak. Her uniform is soaked with blood. I hear her voice. ¶¶
Hi, this is Lynn Burla, and I'm going to be reading The Watcher Wants to Weep by Jonathan Bonner. Pain. Not the sharp stabbing kind like when you cut yourself, or the urgent arresting pain of a bone break. No, this one is a dull, weighty, restricting pain. One that seems unrelenting in its effort to seep into every pore of your skin. It's a pain that makes damn sure you don't forget it's there. Although it's difficult to admit, it didn't start on the day I lost you. On that sunny, yet brisk autumn day, you slipped away from me. No. On that day, I just felt a numbness. Nothing. They tell me it was the shock, that it would take a while for it to register what had happened and what it truly meant. Initially, the condolences, the sad looks, the polite by-the-book comments from family members I'd not seen in years all just bounced off me, like hailstones on a car roof. It wasn't until a week after the funeral that the pain truly hit me. Once it did, it took over. Mornings are the worst. They're the worst now because they were my best times with you then. You'd always wake before me, which meant that you were usually the first thing I'd see each day. That mischievous smile, those freckles, that soft, reassuring, delicate voice. Now, when I wake, if I even sleep, I see just an empty bed. A precious second or two before my brain registers that I'm in our bedroom, alone. Then the pain takes over. It's been months now since you left, although in truth it feels like years. They told me time heals all wounds, but I don't see this ever mending. When you were here, I felt complete. Now it's like a piece of my puzzle has been broken and discarded, leaving me forever unfinished. Nothing helps. Weeping, screaming, talking, even stupid distractions like exercise, high-calorie foods, or, heck, even sex. I even tried starting a fight once in a bar. The other guy decided to be the better man, thinking that I was nothing but a lunatic, and walked away. Truth is, I just wanted to feel another kind of pain to distract me from you, from the endless, aching grief. Anything to stop the pain taking over. Anything at all. Blackness. Then a voice. But not yours. Okay, time's up. The session ends in its usual abrupt way. The dealer sniffs heavily as he powers down the recog throne on which the watcher sits, reclined in the chrome seat like a patient at the dentist. The dealer waits for the watcher to wake, reorganize its programming, and adapt once again to its surroundings. At least, that's what the dealer assumes it's doing. His knowledge of these newer models is still relatively thin. The watcher eventually sits up and gets out of the chair. It wipes a smooth, cold, carbon fiber hand just below its eye. There are, of course, no tears. "That hit the spot?" the dealer asks. "Somewhat," the watcher replies. "Hopefully the next session will provide a more substantial fix." "You know the rules. Any more in one session would toast your interface. Not good for business. Want to try a different emotion next week? I hear that love is all the rage these days." The dealer grins through crooked black teeth. "No," the watcher coldly replies, its circular eyes fixed and unblinking. Okay, grief it is. Same time next week?" The watcher does not respond. Instead, it simply turns, leaves the room, and steps out into the back alley. The dealer grins. He already knows the answer. This particular unit had been coming to him for months now. "Junkies. Backbone of the economy," the dealer sniffs and chuckles to himself as he gets to work resetting the recog throne, ready for his next client. As the watcher leaves the establishment, the sign in oppressive blue neon above buzzes angrily in the rain, shining bright against the dirty brown night sky. A siren screeches somewhere in the distance. The watcher begins the long walk back to its serving quarters across the dark urban sprawl. Its masters will be awake soon, and there will be chores to attend to. It wipes its eyes again. There are no tears, just raindrops.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading Revelations by Mike Adamson. No one knew why they came, and in the end it didn't matter. They came, and that bald fact alone was all the human race needed to know. We could deduce certain things about them. They were bold, they were advanced, and they were not given to subtlety. They had a single obvious message for us, and they hit us over the head with it. They must have been monitoring us for many years, because when the day came, all they had to do was show themselves and leave everything else up to us. I was driving an air cab on the run between Coogee and Circular K when they arrived. They were a bit hard to miss. First, the city air traffic net lit up like Christmas. Then people started screaming, and everything in the air was ordered down. I saw police air cars with their spinners flickering, herding drivers out of the air, and I put my cab down on the skypad of the Zhenyun Hotel Tower, overlooking Sydney Harbor, half a K back from the rocks by the bridge, and copped one of the best views imaginable. Or worst, if you felt that way. My fare was a young lass on her way to an event at the Opera House, and she was as dumbstruck as me. We sat under the long, clear canopy of my cab and stared at the sky, gaping like goldfish, as the alien vessel made its appearance. It seemed to fill the sky from horizon to horizon, the clouds swirling and parting before it, sharp cracks of lightning around as its motion created vast static potential. It was intricately detailed with mechanisms unguessable. Its design seemed to follow no logic the human mind could comprehend, at least as abstract or aesthetic as functional. And it was black as hell, or just blocked out the daylight of a cloudy afternoon and hung over us like the stroke of doom. My fare climbed over from the back into the seat beside me for a better view, and at last offered her hand without taking her eyes from the thing. "Jody," she whispered. "Craig," I returned as softly. People sat in their craft all around us. The pad was now packed, and others were turned away, sent racing for other landfalls or just out of the city as fast as they could move. From the corner of my eye, I saw Jody take out her mobile and start imaging the alien, and realized people had their phones raised to the sky in most vehicles around us. We waited for the streams of light to fall, for the fires and chaos, the devastation. It was obvious we were helpless before them. For a good 20 minutes we expected to die. I saw a guy in the next car praying, a rosary at his lips, and I knew others throughout the city would be doing the same. Prayer mats and shawls, sidewalk services, Muslims facing Mecca. But after half an hour, we were getting bored, and many began to leave their vehicles, walk to the safety rails at the edge of the roof for a better view, and chat. What can I say? The alien ship must have been over 12 kilometers long. It was up there, and it didn't do a damn thing. Not an overt act, not a blinking light pattern, nor a voice of thunder from the heavens. It just hung there, as if it were saying, "You think you're so smart? What do you make of this? Take your time, kiddies. You've got plenty of it." And that was probably the point, the whole point, and nothing but the point. Because in the moment of paradigm shift, the human species seemed to lose its grip on reality. Oh, the better minds among us inferred a lot. These aliens did not give a rat's ass for human notions of pecking order. They revealed themselves in Australia, not America. Nor over London, nor Moscow, nor Tokyo. They were in no rush, and were undoubtedly watching us cockroaches running frantically in the maze when provided the stimulus. Well, we sure put on a show. Besides the praying, there were those running in terror, those demanding the aliens be attacked, those trying to communicate with everything from radio waves to human bodies spelling out welcome on Bondi Beach and other such banalities as an hour became two. And plenty of folks who assumed it was Judgment Day and waited to be raptured. Many more lost their grip on sanity, on life itself, and rained from high places to the disgust of those who were barbecuing in the parks. Centennial, Queens, Hyde, Nielsen, it was over them all, and lay back on beach towels to stare up at the vessel and wait, because the ball was clearly in our visitor's court. That was the worst part, I thought, as I leaned on the railing with Jody, and we got stiff necks from staring at the city-sized thing growing cold in its night-dark shade, watching police air cars cruise cautiously around it. It did nothing. It made no move, replied to no entreaty, just showed itself like a grotesque photo op, and people took freaking selfies with it in the background. According to Facebook stats, over 400,000 such images went up in less than 2 hours. Was that the defining moment in first contact? That the reality of technological alien visitation was absorbed into the human experience as a manifestation of the selfie disease? If so, it boded ill for the future, because about then the ship moved. It turned very gently. Lightning followed it through the clouds and striking to the ocean beyond Sydney Heads, and little by little it faded from our sight. One moment it filled the sky, the next it was receding. All in ghost-like silence but for the rumble of the storm following it, leaving millions of people with a sudden aching hole in their hearts and lives. The population of a city stood and stared and reached after it with supplicating hands, crying out for something, anything, anything but the blank wall they left us. Were we afraid? Were we too eager? Were we aggressive or overflowing with tribal superstition? All the above, and maybe it was one big lesson, because Revelations is now a whole new book, and what we make of it will more than likely govern their attitude to us next time. 'Cause there'll be a next time. They've opened the door, just a crack. And we're waiting with very mixed feelings for the day they choose to step through it.
I am Dennis Corcoran. I'll be reading the story, The Babe, by Laura Ann Gilman. The babe was quiet under the padded blanket, occasional milky burps rising, followed by a soft sighing settling, tiny hands fisting restlessly, as though reaching for something now far beyond their grasp. He kissed the downy head, feeling the odd roughness of the scalp, the too slow beat of its heart, and pushed forward, the warm bundle tucked into the leather apron he'd repurposed to form a sling against his chest. He had been walking for nearly a day now, following nothing more than a story, driven by nothing less than desperation. By nightfall, he had been told, at the first falling of dusk, at the far purple edge of the darkest trees. He nearly missed it, so desperately focused on staying upright, overly alert to the still visible rays of the sun dipping below the tree roof. The babe mewled once, making him look down, and he saw it, the faintest golden silver of light as a door slowly closed in the rock. "Thank you," he told the babe, and slid within, the cold granite brushing against his heel as it shut behind them with a silent click. The babe sighed again. It had not cried once, not even when it should have, not even when he had. Now the weight against his chest was his only comfort, its soft breathing his only truth. The hall stretched before him, faint bluish lights wound along the ceiling, barely enough to see by. He blinked and waited, one hand over the babe's head as though to shield it. The baby burped again, the last of the milk he'd fed it finally settling in its stomach, and fell asleep, its weight suddenly heavier within this leather sling. It was cold here, still and cold and smelling of dust and roses. Far ahead, faint but clear, came the sounds of voices, song and laughter, and the occasional clatter and clang of dishes and goblets, and the sharp tinny notes of noise played on something with strings. It was not courage that drove him, but need, and need would not allow him retreat. They fell silent when he walked into their midst, elegant hands pausing, pale faces turning, eyes glitter sharp and avid on his form, like foxes readying to pounce. But they moved away when he did not stop, clearing a path to where he needed to go. She reclined on a chair made of ebony, her hair the stuff of starlight, her eyes the black of hell. But he had only eyes for the cradle at her feet, a pink bundle within, wrapped in gossamer and fur. "Human, you come uninvited." Her voice was the crackle of ice and the snap of burning wood, and she draped a careless pale arm over her lap, resting her fingers on the ruby-red drape of her gown. He watched her, and he waited, and he did not speak. She smiled, and he supposed she thought it warm and sweet, "but still, let us not be inhospitable. You have come such a long way. Will you not join us as we dine?" He shook his head and looked at the cradle at her feet, the weight at his chest sniffling faintly, as though sensing the change in the air. He could risk no delay, fall to no snare or trickery, to be out before the sun had risen again, or lose all hope of freedom. "That at your feet is mine which you have taken from me." She tilted her head to look at the cradle, then back at him, coyly confused. "Yours? I see in you no womb that brought it forth, no breast to suckle it. Flesh of my flesh, the bloom of my seed." He had come this far. He had come so far, and he filled his voice with the deep roots of the certainty of this. "The babe is mine, taken from his mother's breast as she breathed her last, and he was not given freely by either of us. You have no right to him, and you will return him to me." That is what he had been told, that if he stood there before the queen and laid claim of blood and law, she would not be able to refuse. But there were tricks they would use, ruses they would employ. Be in with dusk and out with dawn. Do not take what they offer, but only claim what is his by right, and leave with nothing more. He thought she might argue with him, but a figure to her left moved, a slithering of silver gowns and a whisper like cold wind, and she narrowed her eyes, then laughed a brightly brittle noise. And you have brought our payment back, like a merchant ill-satisfied. Well, then, so be it. Hand it back and take your babe. He drew back a hand to the leather and shook his head. This, too, is mine. You abandoned it without regret when you stole mine. With his mother's last breath, she kissed his brow and named him. With the first of her milk, I fed him. I will have them both, my blood and my heart. They are all that is left of my family, and you have no claim. Another whisper swept the cave, sparkling off the glittering points of rock in the walls, sliding across the polished floor, pooling and swirling around the queen, who glittered most fiercely at it all. Silence, she said, and the hall ceased to have sound at all. She smiled, and it was not a kind smile, but he thought uneasily that there was something of respect to it. The look a wolf might give to another if they passed each other in the woods, the thought made him uneasy, but he did not blink nor back down. Keep it then, she said. This exchangeling has no value to us, once corrupted with mortal milk. It seems as though she were about to speak further, then flicked those long, pale fingers at him, a clear gesture to take the babe and be gone. He crouched, careful of the weight he already carried, aware of the eyes on him, and scooped the babe into his arms, leaving the fur and gossamer behind. He could feel the soft warmth of its body against the cool air, and quickly shifted the leather cradle at his chest to make room for one more. And then he turned and walked out of that chamber, out from under the stony mound, cautious, exhausted, and still mourning, but comforted now by the two tiny heartbeats, one fast and one slow, held warm against his chest.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.